The developments in Genesis have been fascinating. We've gone from Abraham being promised a great name, being promised descendants, being promised to be a blessing to all nations of the earth. From there, we go to and a promised land. We looked at Isaac's life, and then we've looked at Jacob. And over the course of the next few weeks, we're going to look at the relationship between Jacob's sons, focusing especially on one of the sons, Joseph. Joseph is going to be an interesting figure for a few reasons. He's going to suffer in some pretty startling ways at the hands of his brothers. He is going to find vindication, and rather than responding in bitterness or even pouring forth wrath on those who mistreated him, we're going to find unity. And what is going to end up being the case by the end of Genesis is that we're going to find the children of Israel in Egypt, which is going to set the stage for the Exodus. So there's a lot that we're going to be looking at over the course of the next couple of weeks. But as we talk about Joseph's life, one thing that I don't want you to miss is the fact that in some ways, Joseph is a foreshadowing of the earthly ministry of the Lord Jesus Christ. In fact, many people see Joseph as what biblical scholars call a type of Christ. Now, what do I mean when I describe a type? Well, I'm going to read for you from Basic Bible Interpretation. This was written by Roy B. Zook, and it says this: A type may be defined as an Old Testament person, event, or thing having historical reality and designed by God to prefigure or foreshadow in a preparatory way a real person, event, or thing so designated in the New Testament and that corresponds to and fulfills or heightens the type. All right, so we're going to find that some of the things that Joseph experiences anticipate the ministry of the Lord Jesus Christ. For instance, he's going to be betrayed by his brothers. He is going to be mistreated. He's going to suffer. We're going to find that ultimately salvation, deliverance, and unity are going to come about through him. So it's going to be a very interesting study, and I hope that as we read through these chapters, that you can anticipate the works of the Lord Jesus Christ in the New Testament. So this would be the foreshadowing, and then of course we see the fulfillment in the New Testament. With that, let's go ahead and look at Genesis chapter 37 after our introduction. Genesis 37 begins this way: Jacob lived in the land where his father had stayed, in the land of Canaan. This is the account of Jacob's family line. Joseph, a young man of 17, was tending the flocks with his brothers, the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives, and he brought their father a bad report about them. Now Israel, remember that's Jacob's nickname, now Israel loved Joseph more than any of his other sons because he had been born to him in his old age, and he made an ornate robe for him. When his brothers saw that their father loved him more than any of them, they hated him and could not speak a kind word to him. I trust that you are familiar with Joseph's coat of many colors. That is what is described here. And we could sort of understand where his brothers were coming from here. There were reasonable excuses or causes for why Israel loved Joseph as much as he did. But just from the perspective of the brothers, they have to feel like they're insignificant, as though perhaps this younger son has no real claim to the inheritance of Israel, not before his brothers, and yet he's treated in such a way that indicates that he is preferred. I don't think this is something that Israel hid very well. It's something that is just perfectly on display. And this giving of a coat is seen as an example of that favoritism. It says that Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him all the more. He said to them, "Listen to this dream I had. We were binding sheaves of grain out in the field when suddenly my sheaf rose and stood upright while your sheaves gathered around mine and bowed down to it." His brothers said to him, "Do you intend to reign over us? Will you actually rule us?" And they hated him all the more because of his dream and what he had said. Then he had another dream. Now, just imagine this, okay? So he has a dream, and it's not enough just that he sort of towers over them, but they bow down and worship him. I grew up with two brothers, and I got to tell you, I can't imagine something like that going over very well. There is a truth, of course, in his dream. We're going to see that down the road. There's going to be a fulfillment to it, and I believe there's a reason why God intended for his brothers to be made aware of this. Because when the fulfillment comes, it reveals that it has been God at work the whole time. This wasn't something, and when I say this, I mean the events that are going to transpire in Joseph's life are not just going to be casual events. These are not just going to be things that randomly happen. We don't believe in things like luck. We don't believe in things like karma. We understand that there is a sovereign God actively at work in the world. And Joseph's life is going to bear testimony to that fact. So I don't want us to lose sight of that, but I think that sometimes we can look at narratives like this and we can ask ourselves, how would I respond? What it reveals about the brothers is not simply that they are young men, and as I just kind of joked, as a young man, as a boy, I could just imagine growing up with my two brothers and one of them, and I now have three brothers, by the way, but through childhood I had two. I can't imagine growing up and having one of my brothers say that they had a dream like this and sort of hold it over my head. That just would not have gone over well. Among the reasons it wouldn't, though, would have been pride. I think sometimes when we're young, we're not as aware of the ambition, of the pride that we have actively at work in our hearts, and we have to address. And as we mature, hopefully we come face to face with this sort of rivalry, with this sort of pride, jealousy, bitterness, all of those sort of things that are obviously boiling under the surface of these brothers. And again, the situation brought these things to the forefront, and I'm not saying that I wouldn't feel the same way they do, because I would have, especially as a young man or as a boy. But hopefully as we grow in our faith, as we mature, these sort of character traits diminish. We see less and less of them, and instead we're able to respond to situations in which we are treated unfairly in a just and gracious way. But before we get there, and we're a long way off, we're going to find that the brothers are not going to respond very positively at all. Joseph is going to have another dream. It's one thing that he had that one dream. They responded the way they did. He's going to have another one. It says, then he had another dream, and he told it to his brothers. Listen, he said, I had another dream, and this time the sun and moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me. When he told his father as well as his brothers, his father rebuked him and said, what is this dream you had? Will your mother and I and your brothers actually come and bow down to the ground before you? His brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept that matter in mind. And I think it's just a practical matter of parenting. You're going to address something like this. And if we're being honest, as we've just read through half of this 37th chapter, you know, Israel has sort of contributed to some degree. If there is a sense of superiority that Joseph would possess, perhaps it's because of the way he's been treated by his father. If his brothers have a little bit of animosity, the actions of Israel might also have helped to shape those attitudes as well. Again, that's not justification for those sort of heart attitudes, but I do think that it is revealing that Israel rebukes Joseph. He rebukes him. And I'm using the name Israel again, just in place for Jacob. But Israel, Jacob, he is going to be somebody who rebukes him because of just the relational strain that could be caused by what he's saying. But also, he kept the matter in his mind. Like, maybe this dream did come from God. Jacob is a man who had previously had encounters with the living God. So it shouldn't seem so foreign to him that God would reveal himself in some way, that God would provide revelation in a manner like this. And so he has to keep it in the back of his mind with the sort of question of, well, what does this all mean? Well, his brothers are sure of what it means. And his brothers are certain that what it means is that this kid's a little punk. I mean, really, if we're putting it in our words, they have this idea that he thinks he's something that he's really not. And by extension, they are far more than what he believes them to be. That is probably more to the point. Anytime that we become jealous of somebody else and we ask, who does he think he is? Or who does she think she is? I think anytime those thoughts come into our mind, what corresponds with that? The thoughts we have about ourselves. Well, I deserve more. I deserve better. I work so much harder. We come up with all these things that we have in our mind of why we are superior. And then if we allow that thought process to continue, where does it inevitably lead? Well, it flows out. The reality is that if you deal with these sort of heart issues and you never address them, you have bitterness in your heart, you have jealousy, there's this rivalry with somebody else. And I'm preaching, by the way, on the topic of unity on Sunday morning. But if you have this issue where there is this constant strife in your heart, and there is this bitterness, this anger, if there is pride in your heart that needs addressed, it is going to overflow into your conduct. People so often justify their sinful thought life by saying, well, it doesn't affect anybody but me. And that's nonsense. First and foremost, it offends the Lord. It is an offense to him. It is a sin against him. God cares about your thought life. He cares about what you harbor in your heart. And he's provided warnings. Remember, Proverbs 4:23 tells us to watch our heart. It is the wellsprings of our life. Everything that we do flows from it, it tells us in some translations. You cannot simply harbor these sort of thoughts, these sort of sinful ideas in your mind and in your heart, and them not overflow. And that's the third person that's affected. The Lord, it affects you, it affects the other person, because it will come out. You cannot hide it forever. And Joseph's brothers could not hold on to this forever. It was inevitable that it would come out. And in the 12th verse, it says, now his brothers had gone to graze their father's flocks near Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph, as you know, your brothers are grazing the flocks near Shechem. Come, I am going to send you to them. Very well, he replied. So he said to them, go and see if all is well with your brothers and with the flocks, and bring word back to me. Then he sent him off from the valley of Hebron. When Joseph arrived at Shechem, a man found him wandering around in the fields and asked him, what are you looking for? He replied, I'm looking for my brothers. Can you tell me where they are grazing their flocks? They have moved on from here, the man answered. I heard them say, let's go to Dothan. So Joseph went after his brothers and found them near there. But they saw him in the distance, and before he reached them, they plotted to kill him. They plotted to kill him. Think about this. They are so overwhelmed by jealousy over their father's treatment of him. They are so bitter because of what they believe he is saying as an extension of the meaning of his dreams, the fact that they are going to bow down to him. Puffed up in pride, they're asking themselves, well, who does he think he is that I would bow down to him? And now it's given way to murderous thoughts and plotting. They've gone beyond even just these thoughts of, you know, it'd be nice to strike him down, to let's plot, let's think about how to do this. Now, I'd like to think that those listening haven't allowed their thoughts to go there. But how often do we allow our thoughts to go to other places of, well, I'm going to get even with somebody, or I'm going to knock them down a peg, or I'm going to make sure that they don't get the promotion that they are after or we are competing for, or I'm going to say something about them on social media that's going to reveal the quote unquote real them. We have all these sort of thoughts that we have that we entertain. If other people knew the real them, the version of them that we see, which, by the way, if we're being honest with ourselves, might be distorted because of our own sinful thoughts. Well, how is that going to play out? It's going to result in us treating somebody very different. It's going to result, if we entertain those thoughts very long, in us actually taking action. They entertain these thoughts and they're plotting. So it's not just that they had this thought pop through one of their minds, somebody brings it up and say, that's not how we joke around or whatever. No, they're plotting. It says, here comes that dreamer, they said to each other. Come now, let's kill him and throw him into one of these cisterns and say that a ferocious animal devoured him. Then we'll see what comes of his dreams. Now, that's pretty dark, isn't it? When Reuben heard this, he tried to rescue him from their hands. Let's not take his life, they said. Let's Don't shed any blood. Throw him into the cistern here in the wilderness, but don't lay a hand on him. Reuben said this to rescue him from them and take him back to his father. So Reuben has sort of this quick thought of, we can't kill our brother. I mean, it's one thing to say he's a little puffed up in pride. It's one thing to say our father treats him better than he should. It's one thing to say that, you know, I'm a little bit too significant to bow down and worship my little brother. I mean, come on, you know. But murder is still a step pretty far. And not just murder in general, and that's really, really bad, but murder of our own brother. We cannot do that. Let's not do that. So he's having this sort of thought. And says, so when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, the ornate robe he was wearing, and they took him and threw him into the cistern. The cistern was empty. There was no water in it. That is very good news for Joseph, I might add. As they sat down to eat their meal, they looked up and saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead. Their camels were loaded with spices, balm, myrrh, and they were on their way to take them down to Egypt. Judah said to his brothers, "What will we gain if we kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him. After all, he is our brother, our own flesh and blood." His brothers agreed. What? They have this thought. They're plotting together. You ever watch these true crime shows? And you know, one person going a little crazy or being really depraved and doing something even horrific doesn't seem that shocking to us, because in a fallen world, it seems to happen all the time. But what shocks me sometimes is people will meet other people who have the same sort of criminal intent. They plot out crimes together. And you think, how do those conversations even begin? Like, who brings up the topic? You're just sitting around the dinner table talking or hanging out with friends at a ball game, and somebody's like, hey, we should go do this. And they go, oh yeah, that sounds good. Like, how do these conversations develop? And we find here that they're willing to have this conversation. They think, you know, let's make a few bucks off him while we're at it. Like, let's not just leave him here. Let's not kill him. Let's make a few bucks off our brother. And so that's what they're going to do. They're going to sell him into slavery. Right from the beginning, by the way, slavery, human trafficking, these are described in very negative terms. What happens to Joseph is not a positive thing. They intend evil for him. And I want you to remember that phrase, because we're going to come back to it in a few weeks. They intend to do evil to their brother. That means a human trafficking, slavery. These things are evil in the sight of God, and the people who suffer at the hands of sinful men and women as a consequence, they are victims, and God's people should be very concerned about their condition. It picks up in verse 28. So when the Midianite merchants came by, his brothers pulled Joseph up out of the cistern and sold him for 20 shekels of silver to the Ishmaelites who took him to Egypt. When Reuben returned to the cistern and saw that Joseph was not there, he tore his clothes. He went back to his brothers and said, "The boy isn't there. Where can I turn now?" Then they got Joseph's robe, slaughtered a goat, and dipped the robe in the blood. They took the ornate robe back to their father and said, "We found this. Examine it to see whether it is your son's robe." He recognized it and said, "It is my son's robe. Some ferocious animal has devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to pieces." Then Jacob tore his clothes, put on sackcloth, and mourned for his son many days. All his sons and daughters came to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. "No," he said, "I will continue to mourn until I join my son in the grave." So his father wept for him. This is one of the saddest moments in the entirety of the Old Testament. You have Joseph, Israel, the heir of the promise, the one who is going to see this great nation come from his children. And one of his sons, whom he loves the most, who he just envisions, I trust, the descendants coming from, and the blessings that correspond with all of God's promises being fulfilled through. He's dead. And you have Israel here weeping. And he's so broken that he can't even be consoled. And I, as a pastor, as just a human being, I've wept alongside people who lost children, grandchildren, spouses, fathers, mothers, grandparents. And they're difficult realities. They're very hard. And sometimes the measure of somebody's hurt is so significant that you don't even know quite what to say. You just weep with them. Right here, the brothers aren't able to console their father for many reasons. One being that his loss is so severe, but the second is that they know the truth. They're responsible for their father's grieving, and they don't say a word. That's the part of this narrative that I find to be most disturbing. Every part of this has been problematic and evil. But to watch your own father grieve in this way and to have no reaction at all, to not say, you know, let's go get our brother back. Let's pay the 20 shekels. Let's get him back. Let's go find him. We can't see our father like he's going to live the next few decades like this. And we're just going to stand by. Are we going to honor, you know, his memory? Are we going to, every time we hear his name, are we going to say something positive about him? Are we going to pretend like we weren't bitter? They say nothing. And it says, meanwhile, the Midianites sold Joseph in Egypt to Potiphar, one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard. We find that Joseph, his story hasn't ended here. This isn't it. He was sold off to one group of people. How are they going to treat him? They flip him. They sell him, likely for more, to the house of Potiphar. And if you think that things are going to get easier for him there, well, they're actually going to for just a moment, and then they're going to get much harder. It says, now Joseph had been taken down. This is chapter 39. Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt. Potiphar, an Egyptian, who was one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him there. The Lord was with Joseph so that he prospered, and he lived in the house of his Egyptian master. When his master saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord gave him success in everything, that is, in everything that he did, Joseph found favor in his eyes and became his attendant. Potiphar put him in charge of his household, and he entrusted to his care everything he owned. From the time he put in charge of his household and of all that he owned, the Lord blessed the household of the Egyptian because of Joseph. The blessing of the Lord was on everything Potiphar had, both in the house and in the field. So Potiphar left everything he had in Joseph's care, with Joseph in charge. He did not concern himself with anything except the food that he ate. Joseph now has endured tremendous suffering. I mean, being betrayed is a very difficult thing to wrestle with. Having been betrayed like he was, now being treated like property, had been incredibly dehumanizing and difficult. He does not control his future at this point. He has no control over himself or where he's going to go or if his life is going to be blessed at all. He could have been sold into hard labor, but God continued to bless him. And I think sometimes it's difficult to see God's hand of blessing in our lives because we just focus on the worst parts of our circumstances. I've never been a slave. I can't imagine how difficult that would be. I've never been betrayed in the way that he was. I cannot experientially talk about what he must be suffering, but I can say from a distance it would be horrifying. And there are people who go through difficult situations and that's all that they see. If there is a God, I wouldn't be suffering right now, they might reason. Or if God loved me, things like this wouldn't happen. But we live in a fallen world and people have free will. They have the opportunity to choose to sin. And by the way, as an extension of their depraved and sinful and fallen nature, that is what the unbeliever can default to. That is all that they default to. We find here that Joseph's brothers had treated him in such a way. Now the Midianite traders had sold him off as well, but God had not forsaken him. God was still actively at work in his life. But that didn't mean that hardships weren't going to continue to come. It says, now Joseph was well built and handsome, and after a while his master's wife took notice of Joseph and said, come to bed with me. But he refused. With me in charge, he told her, my master does not concern himself with anything in the household. Everything he owns, he has entrusted to my care. No one is greater in this house than I am. My master has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How then could I do such a wicked thing and sin against God? Joseph recognizes that sexual immorality would be a sin against God. This idea that people have today, well, it doesn't affect anybody else. Nobody sees, it doesn't matter. It does matter. It's a sin against God. God created sexual intimacy between one man and one woman for life. And here we find that this would be a breaking down of that order. In fact, it would be an affront to that order because this would be an extramarital affair. And Joseph saw this as sin. God's people throughout church history, when people have fallen into sin, they've justified their sexual immorality. They've justified things such as idolatry. They've justified things such as lust. There is no justification. It is always a sin against God. That is why Job in Job 31 said, I have made a covenant with my eyes that I would not look with lust upon a woman. In 1 Corinthians chapter 6, it tells us that we ought to flee immorality because you are not your own. You have been bought with a price. Joseph understood that he belonged to God, that he was accountable for the decisions that he made in life, and that he was to be responsible for his own vessel. He was not to be given over to lust, even if somebody was enticing him to do so, because to do so would be to sin against God. It says, one day he went out into the house to attend to his duties, and none of the household servants was inside. She caught him by his cloak and said, come to bed with me. But he left his cloak in her hand and ran out of the house. When she saw that he had left his cloak in her hand and had run out of the house, she called her household servants. Look, she said to them, this Hebrew has been brought to us to make sport of us. He came in here to sleep with me, but I screamed. When he heard me scream for help, he left his cloak beside me and ran out of the house. Not only has Joseph now been betrayed by his brothers, not only have they been jealous and envious of him, not only did they plot to kill him, but then decided to sell him off in slavery, and not only did the Midian traders to whom he was sold in turn sell him off to Potiphar's house, not only then was he enticed by the wife of Potiphar to sin and to act in disobedience to God, but in his resolve, he has stood his ground. He has remained a God-honoring man, and now he is facing false accusations. How many people have faced false accusations in life and become so angry and bitter and felt like they had to contend for their own way? They had to fight for their own name. They had to do whatever it took, even if that meant tearing somebody else down to reveal how great they were. Well, that's not what God calls us to. God is the one who gets vengeance on the behalf of the saint. God is the one who rewards the just and punishes the wicked. And I know that it's very difficult in this life to trust those things, especially our reputation and our name to God. But to trust that all things are going to work out for the good of those who love God, who are called according to his purpose. Things aren't going to look like that for Joseph, not for a while. In fact, this chapter ends with Joseph being thrown into prison. Potiphar wonders, why has this man taken advantage of me in this way, even though Joseph had done no such thing? Sometimes people believe very negative things about us because of what they have heard, because of the sinful actions and words of other people. But I want you to have confidence that God is actively at work in the world. He knows, he sees, and he rewards the just. We need to entrust ourselves fully to his care and to continue to be faithful, not becoming bitter towards other people, but instead saying, Lord, I belong to you. Allow me, empower me to serve you. Help me to trust you even through the darkest of situations. Next week, we're going to see what happened with Joseph as the situation would even get worse. But then God was going to show his sovereign hand, his blessed hand, over Joseph's life. I look forward to unpacking that with you next week. May the Lord bless you.